touchdown machine for the Houston Cougars.
Sasser again, just kind of taking over right now.
That's NBA stuff right there. He is a baller.
Stick it in your pipe and smoke it, baby.
Yes! Welcome to the Scott Lamore Podcast. We're back here in our early to mid-week slot talking all things Houston Cougars. Of course, going to talk plenty about a Cougar men's basketball program that continues to look very much the part of the number one team in the country. Maybe even gotten a little help this week retaining that spot for the long-term future, not the least of which from the play of the team. On the court and plenty other of Cougar sports happenings as well, some women's basketball, a number of sports either just started their season or just started their 2023 slate. So we got plenty to talk about outside the basketball programs. We are really starting to get into that sweet spot where there's lots of Cougar sports to talk about, Dustin. And it's another really positive night. I realize there are people out there that do school-specific podcasts. I would like to think we are on the high end in terms of talking about sports. And it's really something that I think we don't take for granted that we get to come on here, talk a fair amount about Cougar sports, and a lot of it is pretty good. So we're feeling grateful. Grateful is the word tonight, is it not, Dustin?
Yeah, I like grateful. Grateful to, I mean, anytime you get to watch and cheer for the number one team in the country, you got to be grateful for that, and grateful to have heading into to the bat and ball sports before too long. So excited about what we got going on. Excited about some transfers we're going to talk about right at the end of the podcast. Excited to have more Patreon patron questions or question to answer. So plenty to get to. So I think we should probably go ahead and jump into it, Sam. After I know you're going to tell the good folks about some other stuff, I guess, before we jump into the meat of it. But might as well get going.
I got things to plug, Dustin. As you
plug,
well,
plug,
you
plug away,
to,
Sam. Plug,
plug, plug, plug. As you mentioned there, of course, perks for our patrons. There are a number of you who have made the plunge and decided to support our show and our effort to put out regular premium content and give perks. Do the things we had always kind of hoped to do in several years of soliciting your donations. We really appreciate that. I would love to have you, if you haven't done so already, among our patrons. Check out the premium podcast our good friend Bobby and I just did about the 2023 Cougar football class. I think we did a good job, while not pretending to be recruit nicks, really breaking down the class person by person and also kind of looking at the bigger picture takeaways of the Cougar football recruiting class and what that bodes for that program going into the Big 12. We're, of course, proud members of the 10-12 network here. Got to plug the 10-12 pod, talking all things of what is just, even by that conference's standards, an absurd men's basketball season, really good season on the women's hoop side as well. Please follow them on Twitter at TEN12 Network. Follow or subscribe, excuse me, the 10-12 podcast, wherever you put podcasts in your ears. And got to mention, as I always do at the top here, we're also brought to you tonight by our good friends at the good brand, Homefield Apparel, homefieldapparel.com, makers of incredibly comfortable vintage collegiate apparel. Of course, check out their great Houston Cougar collection, along with hundreds of schools, as our friends at Homefield actually announced in the past couple weeks that they'll be debuting 17 new schools to their collection this year to go along with the hundreds I just mentioned a moment ago. As I said, a fantastic Cougar collection. You, the listener, can save 15% off that on your first order just by entering the promo code Holman12, H-O-L-M-A-N-1-2, like Scott and Holman, at checkout. That's all you gotta do. Literally typing in 8 characters into a text box, and you're gonna save on incredibly comfortable and cool, unique, vintage collegiate apparel. And again, whether you won life's lottery and you're a Houston Cougar fan, you're just a curious non-Cougar fan listening, but has a team that you like, who has gear, on that side, Homefield's got really fantastic wearables for whatever you're looking for. So homefieldapparel.com, please go there. Please support our great company that supported our little show in the process. So good start tonight. We're going to go in chronological order. Sometimes we like to get a little fancy with that with your Cougar men's basketball program and talk first about last week's win over the USF Bulls, the last regular season meeting between these teams as conference mates. And I'm not going to do any revisionist history here. This was a game the two of us, I think, expected U of H to win, and not one that we expected U of H to win with any kind of drama or doubt at any point. And I think in some ways you can look back at the result last Wednesday where the Cougars had a, we certainly know by now, much closer than comfortable win at home over the Bulls. And what I think, make no mistake about it, we certainly did not expect for, I would say, 37, 38 minutes of that basketball game to be some degree of uncomfortable. Certainly not expecting USF to notch And here's season high. I should have checked that. There's a season high. Certainly didn't expect USF to score 77 points. Certainly the highest allowed by the Cougars to date. You know, some things, and I think we're going to get to it. You look at this USF team now with the game in retrospect, you're like, okay, I can see why that team maybe had some of the ingredients to make this game uncomfortable as Cougar team, but I don't think we had really on our bingo card, Dustin, that this would be a 4-point deficit well into the second half to the visiting Bulls.
No, absolutely. We mentioned, I will say, we did mention in the preview that both of USF's games against good teams this year, Auburn and Memphis, they held leads in the second half before eventually losing. But, I think if you go listen to our last episode, you will also hear that we did not expect USF to pull a repeat performance against the Cougs. And they did that. They held leads in the second half. That's exactly what happened. They repeated that as well. Notable that the Jairus Walker was unavailable due to illness. But nonetheless, Houston opened the game playing one of their worst halves of basketball this season. Tyler Harris came out just playing with his hair on fire, completely out of his mind. And this is a USF team that we mentioned in the preview was one of the worst teams in the country making free throws. And of course, they shot 80% in the first half, nearly kept that up for the entire game as well, all combined to make it just a 1-point Houston lead going into halftime. And they came out in the second half. USF did, still completely unfazed by facing the number one team in the country in their building in front of a raucous crowd. The Bulls quickly took the lead, led by as much as five, led for the majority of the first several minutes of the second half. I was at this game with my partner, expected it to be a nice, just fun game, but we could just be kind of casually chatting during the game and not being too stressed out. Didn't get that. But ultimately Marcus Sasser just would not be denied in this one. The Bulls leading, like I said, leading by five with 14 minutes to play. Sasser went on a personal single-handed 8-0 run to give the Cougs a 3-point lead that they would not relinquish the rest of the way, part of his career high 31-point performance. The Cougs were able to push the lead to double digits in the late stages of the game, but even still, USF didn't go away. They chipped away, got the lead back to just six with just over a minute to play. It wasn't until Marcus Sasser converted a back-breaking 4-point play with about a minute to go that this one finally was put away and dusted for good. It's definitely a game that leaves one feeling a little bit funny afterwards, because I think that, like I said, you have to acknowledge that this was not a game we expected to be this close. This was a game I think KenPom gave USF like a 1% chance of winning and expected like a 20-something point margin. Houston played very poorly in many aspects. They nearly lost the home game to a team that just isn't that good. You can't really sugarcoat that too much. But I think it's worth noting that a lot of things didn't go Houston's way in this one, from Jairus Walker not being available, right as he kind of seemed like he was hitting his stride got sick and wasn't able to play. You had your opponent, I think, playing their best game of the year. You had the officiating crew putting on an absolute clown show. And, ultimately Houston does still avoid the upset, even with all of that. So, to kind of use the baseball analogy, sometimes you don't have your best fastball. You still have to find a way to get outs anyway. If you're a fan of college basketball, you know that no team, no matter how talented, no matter how well coached, they don't bring their A game every single night, and you have to find a way to win games even when you don't bring your A game. So, am I happy that Houston almost lost to USF? No, not especially, but I can say that, and then I can also say that I am happy that they showed character, and with everything that wasn't going their way, still managed to avoid the upset.
And we did talk about how veteran this USF team was as well, their go-to scorer, certainly coming in, and we saw it born out in for TS Center last week, is fifth-year senior Tyler Harris, a guy who's seen U of H on a double-digit number of times probably over his long college career at this point, and both of their front court stars at least playing their fourth year of college basketball, including Russell Chewa, who I thought was extremely effective, not just on the offensive end at times, but I thought he also kind of changed what the Cougs could do offensively just because of the size he brings as well. I don't think a size that's not common anymore. You don't just go into a game assuming every college team is going to have a guy like Russell Chewa, a legit 7-footer, a well-built 7-footer with, I think, some, as much as we may poorly aged a big deal of him not having very many blocks, you saw a genuinely skilled big man there, a guy who I think has developed over the course of his college career. Not to mention you were missing Jairus Walker with 100-plus degree fever, who you'd seen him certainly come on in the previous wins over SMU and Cincy prior to last Wednesday's game. And I think what made this game so close and one that we had to sweat out a fair amount was something you mentioned, USF going really against some of their season-long tendencies, doing the things that I think Kelvin Sampson said in his post-game comments, the kinds of things that cause upsets. You know, USF being this terrible free throw shooting team, being a terrible free throw shooting team, and us talking about it being this weird, almost multi-year, multi-coach or multi-head coach in the program kind of problem, and that they went out and shot almost 14% over their season average at the line. Russell Chewa, a guy around 60% for the season, going an almost perfect 8 of 9 from the charity stripe. And this was a USF team on the whole that was better at shooting from three previous seasons, whereas I think previous USF teams were bad or terrible by any definition. This team was more just middling or slightly below average. This was certainly a team with a higher ceiling there, but still shot way above the season average. It wasn't the best defense on Tyler Harris. I think Samson specifically singled out Jamal Shedd, saying that he didn't do the best in terms of when he was on Harris. And kind of, I think he mentioned specifically Jamal Shedd getting his defensive mojo back. But there were times where Harris would hit a shot and you didn't think, oh, well, this player didn't do this. It was just like, how'd he hit that? Or just like, he's just feeling it. Like he very much would have had that little flame circling around him, NBA Jam style, if our reality imitated NBA Jam. But it wasn't all about those two things, but I think those two things are how those big Titanic upsets happen. And I thought about the last really big Titanic upset we had to talk about with this program back in the 2020-2021 season out at ECU. That was a bad offensive Pirates team that made nearly half their threes, and I think maybe a little bit less fluky, also had a guy that, regardless of how well they were shooting from deep, would have been a matchup problem in Jaden Gardner. It has to be a combination of doing some things completely out of character for your team and also maybe having some of the ingredients to be a matchup problem from the start. USF did some things that they're probably, I would say almost certainly, not going to be able to do the rest of the season against a very good team, but they had some of the ingredients there already. They just needed Tyler Harris to have a good night. They needed Russell Chewa to be really locked in, and you almost saw it. And I did mention Jamal Shedd's, I think, maybe not to standard defense on Tyler Harris sometimes, but you also needed Jamal Shedd, who I think had been kind of in a mini offensive funk in the games prior to the USF game, bringing what he brought offensively. Those 20 points coming in handy, and I think giving him some confidence that we saw in the coming game against Tulane. And you can only do so much extrapolation from one game, and it's worth underscoring that this one game has very much been the exception to the rule for this team, but you were kind of starting to see the ingredients of an upset there. And like you said, you're not going to have your A game every night. So good to see the Cougars win this one. And I think not necessarily a game that we're going to probably remember in a few weeks, much less at the end of the season. That's the great thing about these close wins. Unless it becomes an indicator of where the season's heading and terminal problems with the team, it's not really going to be something that you're going to think about for another week or two afterwards, even if it was a bit painful to deal with in real time, as opposed to, I think, what we were all kind of expecting when we saw USF on the schedule for last week.
Yeah, someone said in our mentions on Twitter after this one, an ugly win is better than a pretty loss any day. And, you know, we've said it a couple times this year. It's hard to keep your head screwed on straight when you're ranked number one, you've blown a bunch of teams out, and everybody keeps telling you how great you are. So to have that reality check and still walk away with a W is something that can be valuable long term, even if it was certainly heartburn-inducing watching this one. But yeah, you mentioned Russell Chewa and how much we, or at least I, made a big deal about him only having two blocks on the year. I swear he blocked.
Clear, I'm not trying to clown on you. That was worthy of me. He was a legit 7-footer who only had two blocks in it over half a season. So I'm not trying to give you grief there. Sorry.
No, but I swear he blocked Marcus Sasser's shot at one point in this one when Marcus Sasser was driving to the lane, and neither he nor anyone on USF got a credit for any blocks in this game in the box score afterwards. So maybe that's why he only has two blocks. Maybe there's a grand conspiracy among scorekeepers across the country to not give him credit for the block shots he actually has. Maybe that is the answer for why he still only has two official blocks in the air. I don't know. I absolutely refuse to rewatch this game to confirm that he did block a shot, but I feel crazy that I was sure I saw it and even texted you during the game, oh my God, Russell Chewa blocked shot. And then afterwards, no one for USF had a block in the box score. So I don't know what's going on there, but regardless, you know, I think it's notable, you know, when we talked about Marcus Sasser this offseason deciding to come back for his senior year, I think we certainly had visions of what that meant was it was going to be him playing in March, him playing these, you know, sexy games against these big teams and you know, in the NCAA tournament. But him coming back also paid huge dividends in games like this, because obviously if Marcus Sasser doesn't come in and have a career high 31 points in this one, then U of H doesn't come away with this win. So it's not just, you know, you need big players, not just to win the real fun games that you're going to remember forever, the, you know, the NCAA tournament games and everything like that. You need those big players to step up big in games like this and games that you feel like you should have won, games that you feel like shouldn't have been that difficult. The reason why this is going to be a game that we can forget about and not think too much about a week or 2 weeks or a month from now is because Marcus Sasser showed up and just refused to lose in this one. I was going to say, Jamal Shedd, like you said, you know, not his best defensive game probably, but also just on the other end, hit a ton of shots, ended up with 20 points, 1 point away from the career high that he set in the Sweet 16 game against Arizona last year. Much more efficient against USF than he was in that Arizona game as well, where he shot, missed, I think it was like 5 of 16 or something like that. Very efficient 20 points in this one. So, you know, as much as the, like I said, the first guy we have to talk about is Marcus after this game. You know, if Jamal comes out and has a so-so or below average shooting night, or kind of doesn't, you know, kind of get out of the little bit of a shooting slump that he's been in, then this Houston, I think, is still in real trouble. So credit to him. He was able to kind of divorce the being frustrated by he had to have been frustrated by some of the shots that Tyler Harris hit in this game, but he was able to break away from that and still contribute on the other end and make sure that the, you know, Tyler Harris versus Jamal Shedd, you know, point margin was only, what, I guess 11, as opposed to it could have been a much greater number the way that Tyler Harris was shooting. So impressed with the way that that Shedd played offensively at the very least, and like I said, happy that the Cougs were able to avoid the upset.
And obviously, in terms of what Marcus Sasser did in this game, that career high 31 points, that's going to grab the headlines. And it was really impressive. It was a refusing to let your team kind of lose when a lot of things are breaking against you kind of performance. But can't overlook the defensive work he did on Tyler Harris, which kind of sounds like a weird thing to talk about because we just talked about what a career night Tyler Harris had. But we'll note that he was fairly quiet when the Cougs retook the lead for good and kind of built a lead that I don't think it was a lead that comfortably saw the Cougars out in this game. I think we spent even the minutes down the stretch where the Cougars held a lead sweating this. And like, is USF going to hit two more freaky shots and we're going to, oh my God, be in position to lose this game? But he really kept Tyler Harris from doing anything until I think the deficit was too much, even for his just freaky ability to hit shots last Wednesday night, to even make up for that. He really was quiet during, I think it was like a 7-8 minute stretch in the second half where USF just couldn't buy a bucket and really was only getting anything happening offensively through an officiating performance that we didn't love, though probably wasn't a net positive to either team. But even that career night, I still think Marcus Sasser came in big both on the offensive and defensive sides of the ball. And I think that's where Marcus Sasser's grown from freshman year. Marcus Sasser, who's a really promising scorer, obviously had the makings of a good defensive player, to really, really good scorer who now is in his fourth year in a Kelvin Sampson program and is showing the requisite kind of junkyard dog defense. And I'm not going to, again, like I said earlier, take too much away in terms of big picture stuff from this one, but I will say that I think now that we have almost, I think, 20 games worth of data on this season, I do think we've seen some kind of general types of teams that give this U of H team trouble. Or I guess trouble relative to the dominance we've seen from a team that is deservedly the number one in the country for a decent amount of the current season. You've seen teams with a lot of size give the Cougars problems. You saw an Oregon win that was mostly comfortable back in November, but their big man, Ifeoli Dante, really gave the Cougs problems, had a double-double, really changed what the Cougs were able to do offensively in the paint and with their big men in that one. And Alabama didn't beat you solely based on the size, but I think it's not a coincidence that no Tide player was more effective and valuable than their 6'10 freshman big man, Noah Clowney, who also had a double-double. UCF, excuse me, they really, I will get to USF, but they really don't like it if you confuse them, gave the Cougs a much tougher game back on New Year's Eve. And I think in no small part, UCF gave you that tough game because the Knights are one of the 30 tallest teams in the country. And in particular, their big man, Michael Durr, who I think his line in that game doesn't tell the full story of how much he impacted what the Cougs were able to do offensively. And USF, which we've talked about a fair amount at this point, giving the Cougs some problems and changing what the team could do for long periods of time. I think especially the challenge of building an offense around Russell Chaitwa. And so I guess it kind of makes sense that this team maybe has a weak spot there. I think it was easy to forget how much Josh Carlton and having him for his final collegiate season last year as a fifth-year guy really gave the Cougars the kind of big-bodied, but I think much to our surprise, really skilled big man who can neutralize the kind of guys that I just got done talking about that have given the Cougars some problems in those previous games. And I think we've also kind of talked off-air about the semi-oddity that's been this team's home performances versus this team's performances away from the Fertitta Center. And again, some of this might be sample size. After today, you've played 12 games at home and 7 games not at the Fertitta Center. That's not an exactly equal sample on both sides, but I don't know. And you can butt in if you think I'm off base here, but I feel like this team's played with a bit more calm and confidence in the games away from home, that the win over a current borderline top 10 Virginia team in a packed house in Charlottesville, beating St. Mary's and a game that kind of looked ugly at the time, but I think now looks like a really strong resume win, and you've had now varying degrees of decisive, really never in doubt wins over Tulsa, Tulane, and Cincy. And again, it might not mean anything. It might just be some kind of oddity that corrects itself over the course of the season, but I don't know. It's just something I've noticed now in what's a little over half a season of basketball. So I guess my last thought, certainly not a pretty game, not a game that we wanted or expected to be close, not a game that either of us are ever dying to rewatch in any form or fashion again. But if this Cougar team takes care of business like I think we all think they can take care of business down the stretch, it's not going to be a game that anyone remembers that much or is hung up on in any way.
Yeah, and I think it is notable that, you know, even after not having the most impressive win over USF, that the Cougs still remain number one in the AP poll and the coaches poll in basically every metric. So not a a loss that I don't think we're completely out of line with even non-Cougar partisans in saying that it's not the end of the world that Houston had a, you know, a little bit closer than we'd like win over over the Bulls. And then the Cougs.
Part of that, I was going to say, is the performance tonight that we just saw against the Tulane Green Wave in New Orleans.
Absolutely. Definitely a more encouraging win as Houston pulled away in the second half to beat Tulane 80-60 just a couple hours before we came on here to record this podcast. And, you know, coming into this one, it sure looked like Houston's three toughest remaining regular season games were going to be this one away to UCF and away to Memphis. And although maybe that changes because, like you said, Houston does seem to be playing a little bit better at times away from home than they are at home. So maybe home to Memphis is going to be a tougher game than away to Memphis. I don't know. But either way, the game on the road in New Orleans, you know, close for a while, but the Cougs end up coming away with what looks like a really strong 20-point victory. And Houston came out at, you know, just shooting the lights out right out of the gates in this one. Started off 13 of 16 from the floor to open the game, pushed the lead to double digits fairly quickly. But Tulane converted a 4-point play in the closing seconds of the first half to cut the lead to 8. And then Marcus Sasser opened the second half for the second straight game, had a one-man 8-0 run, had it to open the second half in this one. This time did it to push the lead to 16 points, but Tulane pretty much straight from there got real hot, scored 17 points in under 7 minutes to pull within 5. But after that, the Cougs clamped down on defense, held Tulane to just 5 points in the subsequent 8 minutes as the Cougs got hot offensively and put the game away. And yeah, another huge game for Marcus Sasser. 23 points on 8 of 13 shooting, all but one of those shots coming from beyond the arc. And, you know, had a little more offensive help in this one. Kind of throughout the game, Juwan Roberts was huge offensively early in this one. 12 of his 15 points in the first 12 minutes of the game really helped Houston build that early lead that they kind of, you know, added to throughout the game after that. And Jamal Shedd, we talked about how well he played, you know, offensively, against USF. Thought he played, you know, maybe even better offensively in this one in terms of his overall game, just real efficient and you know, certainly better overall game in terms of how he played defense as well. 14 points, 7 assists in this one. Part of a Cougar perimeter defense, which, you know, although the Jaylens for Tulane ended up with a combined 38 points, it took them 35 shots to get there. So definitely stronger game all around for Houston. And you know, this one was, like I said, close for a little bit. Got a little bit of heartburn there in the second half when Tulane pulled within 5. But really, really impressed with the way Houston responded. And, you know, seen them do it a lot of times this year, facing a team that, you know, just has their biggest crowd in ages. You know, Tulane been playing basketball for over 100 years, only the 12th time they've faced the number one team in the country, and the first time in their current building had a packed house that was making a lot of noise, especially as Tulane was cutting into that Cougar lead in the second half. But real impressed with the way this team responded, and you know, very strong, I thought, overall team performance to make sure that they got a ultimately fairly comfortable victory.
I think I said at the top something to the effect of a never in doubt win, referring to this one. I'm not going to say around the 15th to 12th minute of the second half, I didn't start to have a little bit of doubt. Tulane really seemed to be heating up. And I'm not going to, because I don't think Tulane is in any way, and that's not an insult to Tulane, because I think there are very few teams in the country that are comparable to this team, but Tulane's not comparable to the Alabama team that's been the lone blemish on the Cougars' record to this point. But it started happening in the same part of the game that the collapse against Alabama happened in, and you're just starting to think, oh no, like, is Tulane going to start feeding off the crowd? Did you maybe get buoyed a bit at the beginning by some unsustainable shooting? And thankfully, the Cougars, I don't think, let those doubts linger in my head that long. And I think it's, if you had told me coming in that this was going to be a game where really for only 2 or 3 minutes of the game did I have any kind of concern about the Cougars being able to win this, and that the Cougars had held a lead for, I would say, 90-something percent of the game and saw it at the end with very little drama, I would have been happy with that. I certainly expected the Cougars to win against this opponent, but like you said, certainly one of the three toughest road games remaining in your schedule, depending on UCF's able to figure out life without a couple key guys for some period of time, might end up being a top two toughest road game. This was a Tulane team coming in that really was playing their best basketball this year. We talked about it. This was a team that came in with expectations, this Tulane team that the program really hadn't had around it recently. And I think pretty modest from the perspective of, I guess, this program and this Cougar program, it's been the last 6 or 7 years, but I think genuinely a place that Green Wave basketball hasn't been in any of these players' lifetimes. And coming off a very decisive win over UCF before that, I wouldn't say as decisive, but I would say still a comprehensive and deserved win over Memphis at the beginning of the year as well. I think that the Cougars were able to dispatch this opponent with, I think, minimal drama. And it sort of reminded me of the Virginia game in one way, Dustin, in that I think we talked a decent amount in the lead up to, okay, this is a good free throw shooting team. This is a team that's good at getting to the line. Are you going to go into their building and just get a whistle happy crew? You're going to get the crew that you got the game before against USF, but you're going to get it in someone else's building. They're going to feed off a crowd that maybe they don't always get. And that might be the recipe for this team finally getting got on the road. And just, we saw once again, the team look really composed, almost the team thriving on going into this building where they're this big draw, where there's student lines out the building. And with all respect to Tulane and their fan base, I don't think they're getting those f-ing lines for East Carolina. Those lines are for the number one team in the country. Those lines are as much to see the Houston Cougars as they are the Tulane Green Wave, and they handle the pressure of that masterfully. I think a really good team performance. The Marcus Sasser performance that maybe we've been expecting to see a little more this year, but I think that's deceptive, because I think Samson said in the post-game comments, I think Sasser's been quite good this year, even when his shots aren't falling. He's a guy that affects winning in a lot more ways than shooting the three ball, but when he's hitting the three ball, you're like, oh yeah, this guy's a really good scorer, and he's also this really all-around good college guard as well. So it was really satisfying to see the Cougars dismantle this team that was playing their best basketball, that was on the emotional high of playing this team, and not to mention handing Ron Hunter another head-to-head loss against the Cougars.
Yeah, there's nothing makes me happier than Ron Hunter making such a stink, after, some players said some mean things to me after we beat them.
Let me read this for you, Dustin. I've never read this on air, and we only have like one more game. It's too late. It's pretty short, I promise. Can I read his comments? Because we've alluded to it, but I don't think we read it in full. This was Ron Hunter's comments about the Houston Cougar men's basketball program. This is not us. Oh, someone said this. This is from his introductory official Tulane press conference. And he's like listing some goals here, so that's a little context. The third one is a personal goal. We played Houston, we being his previous team, Georgia State, in the NCAA tournament the other day. I didn't like how it ended. I didn't like some of the things that some of the players said to me. I don't know if they're a rival of you guys, but they just became a rival of mine. I know this. We'll get to Houston. Houston, you got me the first time. You won't get me again. That's for real.
I announcer voice.
I don't think
Houston,
so.
Houston narrator voice. Houston got to Ron Hunter every single time. I guess there's one game where you don't want to get too cocky, but Ron Hunter has not gotten Houston once.
Yeah, I mean, at the very best, and I'm not going to say it won't hurt if Tulane gets the last regular season game when they play for Chance there. I'm not gonna say that, but at the very best, this guy's going to go 1-6 against U of H in all likelihood in his Tulane career. So I will enjoy those cons. I will let them age like fine wine. We'll, I guess, get back to talking about the actual basketball.
Yeah, in terms of the actual game at Fogelman Arena, you know, turnovers were a big story in this one. You know, we talk a lot about how Houston is so good, rebounds and turnovers. And, you know, for, I think, a team to upset Houston, they have to kind of play them, you know, pretty close to even in both of those categories, because if Houston has a big edge in rebounds or turnovers, then it's just so hard to keep up with this team. And if you had told me before the game that Houston was only going to have 1 second chance point in this one, I would have been nervous, because I go, oh crap, because Tulane is, you know, coming in was, I think, number four in the country in holding on to the basketball. But turnovers ended up being a big story. Actually, turnovers were actually even 14-14 overall, which doesn't sound like a big edge for Houston, but the Cougs did a better job of using turnovers to get out in transition and get high percentage buckets, especially in the first half of this one. They ended up winning points off turnovers 22-10, despite the overall turnover margin being pretty equal. So it ended up being a very big story in this one and helped Houston in a game that they just weren't really getting a whole lot of offensive rebounds. Like I said, 1 second chance point. I didn't look it up, but I can't imagine there have been too many games in the Kelvin Sampson era that Houston had 1 second chance point. So that was, but glad to see Houston getting a lot of points off of turnovers here. And then just offensively, this ended up being the fifth time in seven games that Houston has broken the 80-point barrier, and they've done it despite playing 68 possessions or fewer in every one of those games. This Cougar offense has really gotten stronger as the season has gone on. You know, the close games against the Florida schools, you know, both of those teams got hot offensively. Houston, I think, didn't play their best defense in either of those games. But overall, Marcus Sasser getting hotter, the Cougar offense as a whole only getting better and stronger as the season has gone on, and just really encouraged to see the Cougs, put up a bunch of points against Tulane in their own building and get the 20-point victory.
Yeah, I think credit to this Tulane team. Something we knew they were, I guess, better at, or something they certainly differentiated themselves with from previous Ron Hunter teams, was an ability to keep opponents off the glass with a bit more regularity than they had in the past. This is never going to be a Tulane team that themselves grabs all of offensive boards, because I think Hunter puts a higher priority on getting back in transition. I think it's a stylistic decision. It's not simply that he's recruiting bad offensive rebounders. It's that he's not having his guys go for them in the first place. So that's never going to be something that Tulane under Hunter is especially good at. But unlike the previous three teams that he's had there, they've done a good job, or better job. They're catastrophically bad at grabbing offensive boards, but they're not catastrophically bad at keeping opponents off the boards. And you saw that. And I would say somewhat uncharacteristic 8 rebounds from your Cougars, like you said, the 1 second chance point, not something you're going to see very often with the Kelvin Sampson team. But I think on the flip side of that, something I definitely said in the preview of this was that I think any team that makes it a stylistic decision or a philosophical decision not to grab a lot of offensive boards or not be a team that really aggressively offensive rebounds, I think that's going to make it extremely hard to ever beat this Houston team. It's going to give you a margin that's so razor thin as to be, I think, kind of difficult to achieve. Even if you have a great crowd, even if you have at least one of your guards feeling it, if you're not getting those second chances, if you're not, I guess, stealing those possessions. And another thing we talked about too was that this was going to be a real tempo contrast, that a Tulane team that's one of the fastest in the country versus a Cougar team that I think, also speaking of philosophical decisions, pretty consistently under Kelvin Sampson, is going to have long possession times. And yes, some of that is juiced by the fact that this team gets a lot of offensive boards, and that really, that has an effect. But this isn't a team that even when they aren't getting a lot of second chances, likes to push the pace, go up and down. Just not something they do, and that's fine. This is a very effective offensive team without having to do a lot of running and gunning. And I think you saw maybe at times, especially when the Cougars were struggling, you saw maybe the Cougars get rushed a bit. You saw the game maybe being played a bit more at Tulane's tempo than the Cougars' tempo, but I think on the whole, this was a game very much where the Cougars dictated pace, and that's why we're talking about a mostly comfortable Cougar win versus the upset of this team.
All right, so the Cougs find themselves 18-1 now in American 18-1 overall, I should say, 6-0 in American Athletic Conference play. Still undefeated in the American in a conference where every other team now has at least two conference losses, so a couple games of cushion over the rest of the conference. And now they look forward to hosting Temple on Sunday. So as we look forward to that game, we look at the Owls, who are now in year four of the Aaron McKee era. You know, last year it looked like they had really taken a big step forward. They went 10-7 in conference play after going a combined 10-22 the first 2 years under Aaron McKee. And they did that despite having one of the most inexperienced teams in college basketball last year. And they did it despite one of their stars in Khalif Battle missing all but seven games of the season due to injury. But if you thought that maybe getting a lot of those guys back, that they were going to have another big step forward, hasn't really been the case. They've been, you know, I think hard to pin down is maybe the most objective, honest way I could say it. They opened the year losing to Wagner at home, only to turn around in game two and beat Villanova, although admittedly a Nova team that is struggling to find itself under Kyle Neptune. Most impressively in non-conference play, Temple beat a Rutgers team that has looked excellent this year, including handing Purdue its only loss of the season. Temple also got a double-digit home win over VCU. But then they turned around and closed non-conference play on a three-game losing streak that included a 20-point loss to a thoroughly mediocre Penn team and a home loss to Maryland Eastern Shore, who, like Wagner, is ranked in the 290s of KenPom. The results for Temple have made a little bit more sense in conference play, as they've kind of basically just played everybody close regardless of how good their opponent has been. They had nail-biting road wins over ECU, USF, and Tulsa. They beat Cincinnati by 9 at home. They lost a back-and-forth affair to Tulane that got away from them late. And then in their most recent contest, they played Memphis at home, were tied 59-59 with 2 seconds left before Kendrick Davis hit a ridiculous fadeaway jumper on the baseline to win that one for the Tigers. So Temple led by a pair of 6'5", 4th-year sophomore guards in Khalif Battle, who I mentioned, and Damian Dunn. Dunn, for whatever reason, that doesn't make a lot of sense to me. He's been coming mostly off the bench this year, although he's still averaging nearly 33 minutes per game. Both Dunn and Battle are averaging well into double figures, and they have combined to take over 43% of Temple's shots from the field this year. So certainly, Sam, when we talk about the scouting report, definitely begins with those two. And we've kind of talked about, you know, over these last two games, Houston's, you know, guard defense, that's very much going to be, I think, the focus for the Cougs heading into this one, with Battle and Dunn being very much the focal point of what Temple does offensively.
Would agree. I thought the Owls were an interesting team coming off of last year. They were just outside the top 100 in both net and KenPom, had the fourth best winning percentage of AAC teams. I think most importantly, they did that with an extremely young roster. So it's like, okay, they're just outside the KenPom top 100, not where maybe Temple wants to be ultimately, but if these guys stick around for two or three more years, this could be a really good veteran team at some point. Unfortunately, at least one key transfer kind of nicks that. Jeremiah Williams, who was their starting point guard for most of the prior two seasons, departed for Iowa State in the offseason. And I don't think their injury luck this year is as bad as last year. You mentioned the Khalif Battle injury. They did lose in December starting big man Jameel Reynolds, a guy who actually started his career in the conference at UCF. He broke his thumb back in December, and I think from the usual timetable on that kind of injury, probably won't be back until February. And that's a big injury, because what we talked about earlier with this Cougar team's maybe relative struggles against really big guys, and I think noteworthy that Reynolds has the best defensive rebounding percentage of anyone on the current Temple roster, and almost certainly will not be playing for Tita Center this weekend. You'll probably see in his absence more of Nick Jourdain, Kerr Jankic, and Zach Hicks, who's kind of a tweener. I will say Jourdain was with the Owls program last year, had double-digit points in both games against the Cougs. Hicks was a guy who really came on late as a freshman last year. Local guy, is one of the Owls' highest volume three-point shooters. This is probably Aaron McKee's best offensive team since he's been at Temple now in his fourth year. For the first time, they aren't one of the worst teams in the country scoring inside the arc. They were one of the 20 or so worst the prior three seasons. And this is also his best effective field goal percentage team, though I think they're still outside the national top 100 in that metric, a good free throw shooting team as well. But I think the reason why you haven't seen that improved offense translate into a team that's been consistent or notably improved this year is that this is also probably his worst defensive team. The Owls have really struggled to turn opponents over, and I think the ability of a team to be active defensively and turn the Cougs over, I think, is a kind of prerequisite for an opponent maybe making the game competitive. That was something USF had done pretty well on the season and certainly did early against the Cougars and really making the Cougs uncomfortable. And that's just not something the Owls have done with any kind of consistency this year. And again, I mentioned a bit ago, this was McKee's best offensive team at Temple. And a big reason why that hasn't translated to a better team on the whole is kind of what I talked about. They're not an awful or bad defensive team, other than what I just talked about forcing turnovers and steals, but you're not going to find any areas where they've really been truly excellent either. And this is, like all things Philly, a program that prides itself on the John Chaney, you know, tough blue collar kind of ethos. And this just, I know they're coming off a game where they held a Memphis team that I think is undeniably very skilled and prolific offensively to 61 points. That's no small feat, but you've also seen them have some defensive clunkers against teams drastically worse than the Memphis team I just mentioned. And they're not a great offensive rebounding percentage team either. It's just hard to see an opponent who can't really force turnovers and really doesn't create a lot of second chance opportunities for itself, making the game uncomfortable for the Cougars. At the risk of putting my foot in my mouth like I did with USF, I feel pretty confident saying that.
Yeah, you mentioned Jameel Reynolds likely being out for this one. Their best forward averaging better than 11-6 before suffering a hand injury that's caused them to miss their last eight games. And like you said, yeah, I think it was 10 days ago was the last update I saw. McKee said that Reynolds was still a few weeks away, so it'd be surprised if we see him suited up at the Fertitta Center. And yeah, you mentioned some of the other guys. Nick Jourdain, strong offensive rebounder, shot blocker, had a couple decent games against the Cougs last year, but without Reynolds, that front court really just isn't as strong overall. Reynolds is their best front court scorer. He's their best rebounder, so a big miss for them if he is still not available, which looks like it'll be the case. And I think overall this is a game where Houston's forwards should really shine. I think the Cougars are going to have a significant talent and size advantage in the front court here. And yeah, bottom line, you know, I guess before the USF game, I might have been a little bit cockier about Houston's chances in this one, because I think that Temple profiles a little bit similarly to the Bulls in the sense that they have shown the ability to hang with good teams, but also the ability to lose to bad teams. So I'm maybe a little bit warier of a team like that now after the scare that USF put into Houston. And the thing certainly that scares you that jumps out is that they do a good job of getting to the line and making free throws once they get to the line. So I think this is going to be a game where it's going to be a big deal. Kind of like you mentioned with the Tulane game and the USF game, what kind of officiating crew do you get? Do you get a real whistle happy crew, or do you get a crew that's, you know, happy to kind of let teams both play a little bit physically on defense, which obviously I think benefits the Cougs. But I don't know, from an overall talent standpoint, it still feels like there's a large gap there. You know, when these teams face off again in Philly in a couple of weeks, if Jameel Reynolds is back and close to 100%, I think this is a team that'll scare me a little bit more. But yeah, I don't know, I'm kind of with you. A little bit wary of putting my foot in my mouth, but even with that USF scare still fresh in my mind, this feels like a game that Houston, knock on wood, shouldn't have too much trouble with.
I think if they force turnovers really well, I know that's weird to have one area so influence my general feeling, but if they were an active defensive team, I think I'd be closer to where you are. And this isn't a team incapable of giving the Cougars a game. We just saw it with USF. I think we all, myself certainly included, dial back the hubris a little bit, but again, I think still one the Cougars should win and win pretty comfortably.
All right, then next Wednesday, the Cougs will be at UCF. We'll likely have another episode before then, but as we do these on Tuesday nights, generally, it'll not have a whole lot of time, so we'll go ahead and talk about that now. You will probably remember what a tough game UCF gave the Cougs on New Year's Eve in the Fertitta Center, and you can bet that they're going to be fired up to get the Cougs in their own building. In the intervening games since then, UCF had a surprisingly tough time with ECU in Greenville. They stomped SMU at home, they outlasted Memphis in double OT at home, and then they took a 7-point road loss to Tulane. They'll also take a trip down I-4 to face USF on Saturday before taking on the Cougs. And, you know, there are a couple areas that UCF essentially played Houston to a draw the first time that these teams met, and that's offensive rebounds and points in the paint. But notably, UCF big man Michael Durr led the Knights in that game with 4 offensive rebounds. He had 2 of their 4 blocks in that game. Is definitely their biggest post presence as well. He's been injured and missed their last few games, and John Rothstein voice. Well-placed moles within Orlando tell us that it sounds like he won't be available when Houston comes to town for this one. So I think that's kind of the biggest thing for me, Sam. So I'm real curious to see if Durr's presumable absence will help Houston maybe have more of an edge in this one in kind of the rebounding and the points in the paint categories.
Yeah, I reached out to a good friend of ours who would probably know better than most, and he said something similar to what John Rothstein's well-placed moles says. Well, though it did sound like Darius Johnson, who's missed some recent games for the Knights, that there's a decent chance he'll be back, and I think he was someone that certainly gave the Cougs problems when these teams met last at the Fertitta Center. A guy, Johnson, who's top 20 individually in steal percentage, top 100 in assist percentage. I think you saw how disruptive he could be, and you saw what a good job at times he did getting his teammates really good shots. Taylor Hendricks, the guy just ahead of Johnson, actually is the second highest rated commitment in UCF program history, at least for the recruiting rankings era. I would say definitely your individual headliner, averaging a hair under 15 points and 8 boards per game. A guy, even as a true freshman, who's a true 3-level scorer, a good free throw shooter to boot, had his moments against the Cougs last time out, certainly in that one as UCF kind of really got back in that game at the start of the second half. But I would also say from that one, he was held well below his season averages by the Cougars, was pretty inefficient getting to the points he was able to get to the last time these teams met. Like you said, I think not having Michael Durr is a really, really key injury. Somebody who's the kind of big-bodied throwback big man who's, like we've said it now a number of times in the show, given the Cougs problems, had 8 boards and 2 blocks the last time these teams met. And this is a very, very good offensive rebounding team, this UCF team. They're just behind the Cougars, 11th nationally in team offensive rebounding percentage. I think Michael Durr is going to be a big loss there. Yes, they had 3 different guys with at least 3 offensive boards against the Cougs, 2 who almost certainly will be playing in Orlando. But simply Durr being there and being able to be out there for 32 minutes against the Cougs the last time these 2 teams faced off, I think really made the Cougars uncomfortable, really changed what the Cougs are able to do offensively, because there's that 7-foot presence. And for all the things that Wani Robertson, Jairus Walker do really, really well, and I think we really like those guys as a starting front court, being able to go out there and not maybe have your shot block or have what you're able to do offensively changed by a 7-footer, not really something this front court can do. You don't have a Josh Carlton like guy that can kind of go head to head with Durr, meet Durr at, you know, where he is on size and physicality. That's just not what you have on the roster, even though you have a lot of really good players and a lot of skill there if you're the Cougars. Since the Knights have played the Cougars last, they did have an absolutely wild double overtime 107-104 win at home over Memphis, though struggled pretty badly on the road in New Orleans against the Tulane Green Wave. A 77-69 loss that, following a decent amount of this one in Game Tracker, I think was a lot more decisive than that 8-point final margin have you believe. Tulane controlled this one for a good bit, and frankly UCF got some late points to get that thing under double digits. This was a double digit deficit for a pretty good chunk of that one last time out. So I think what's gonna be really interesting, Dustin, obviously this is gonna be a really good showdown. You're gonna have, no matter what happens between now and then, a really packed building in Orlando, because this is the number one team in the country, and no matter what kind of season you're having, the number one team is gonna bring a pretty good crowd to the building. But immediately before this one, the Knights are going to take a road trip to USF, who maybe a month ago we would have looked at this game and thought, ooh, this could be, get really ugly for the Bulls. I don't know. The way these two teams are playing right now, I'm not saying I'm expecting a USF win, but that team's coming off, you know, the near miss against U of H, a really comprehensive road win over ECU, which I know it's ECU, but I didn't think this USF team had a comprehensive conference road win in them, period. So I don't know, that could be a challenging one. And I don't know if this ends up being a USF upset win in Tampa. I'm curious where UCF's head's going to be at when these two teams meet again next week.
Yeah, you normally don't say trap game when you're facing your biggest rival, because you figure your team should always be up for that. But if you are looking forward at all to facing the number one team in the country, like you said, I think USF is a team that has the potential to give the Knights some trouble the way that they are playing right now. But yeah, I think my two biggest X factors for this one, you mentioned Darius Johnson being injured, has missed a few games now, was their leading scorer when they played Houston at the Fertitta Center with 17 points. So if he is back, that's good for UCF, obviously. But, you know, is he 100%? Is he something close to 100%? that's obviously a big deal because they're going to need him to play well, I think, to have a chance. And then, you know, also UCF is a team that has kind of, you know, been high chaos in terms that they force and commit a lot of turnovers on the year. It was kind of surprising when they faced Houston the first time that neither team really had a large turnover number. UCF wasn't able to force a bunch of turnovers. Houston only had 8. And UCF, you know, they've committed 13 turnovers, but, you know, it's not a... That's not an insignificant, but it's not a hugely game-changing number either. So that is an area where Houston has, you know, at many times this year really dominated teams is in the turnover margin. So definitely curious to see if the Cougs have a more decided edge in that department this time around. Got to call you out, Sam. You're very, very cocky, just assuming Houston will be the number one team in the country for this game, assuming that they're going to beat Temple and not lose that title going into this one. But
Zach Hicks or Khalif Bowler are listening, I'm totally counting you out. You can just put this on your bulletin board, the Lycra Center or wherever you guys practice.
Yeah, but really big game for Houston. You know, it's going to be a tough road game, I think, regardless. You know, and after that game, you know, if you look at, if you believe Ken Pom, which obviously you and I are pretty big Ken Pom stands, you know, Ken Pom sees this as a 6-point game to the Cougs, and then every remaining regular season game until Memphis in the regular season finale, Houston will be favored, according to Ken Pom, by at least 14. So definitely looks like, on paper, at least Houston's toughest game until, you know, March 5th in the regular season finale at Memphis. So, you know, going to be a big, big game for the Cougs for sure.
No doubt.
All right, and switching to women's hoops, the Cougs' only game since we last talked to you guys was a loss to Tulsa, a 70-68 defeat for the Cougs, their first conference loss of the year after their 3-0 start to conference play against the Tulsa team that, along with USF now, is one of the two remaining unbeatens in the American Athletic Conference. And the first quarter was just brutal in this one. Houston started out hot offensively but cooled off quickly, and then Tulsa just got easy shot after easy shot and just didn't miss any of them. The Cougs gave up 28 points in the first quarter to trail by 13 after the first 10 minutes. You know, Houston rebounded, played well in the second quarter, cut the lead to as little as 3 points, but Tulsa closed out the first half strong, pushed the lead back to 8. And then the third quarter kind of looked a lot like the first, where Tulsa just repeatedly took advantage of Houston's aggressive passing lane defense by using back cut after back cut after back cut to get easy shot after easy shot after easy shot. Tulsa had a 22-point third quarter and took a 14-point lead into the fourth. But, you know, once again, Houston didn't surrender. They opened the fourth quarter on a 9-0 run to pull within 5. But from there, it just seemed like every time Houston made a shot, Tulsa responded. Every time Houston had a chance to get within a couple points, they weren't able to do it. The Cougs were able to actually pull within 3 in the closing seconds. They got a clean look for Layla Blair with 7 seconds left at what would have been a game-tying 3-pointer, but it wouldn't go down. And ultimately, Tulsa comes away with the 2-point victory. So, you know, we knew this one was going to be tough playing on the road against a Tulsa team that was playing well. But, you know, in a 2-point loss, there were just so many frustrating things that you leave the game going, you know, man, what if that had been different? You know, what if Tulsa didn't have a 20-4 edge in free throw attempts? What if Houston shot better than 5 of 19 from beyond the arc? Although that is, unfortunately, admittedly, right in line with their season averages in terms of shooting percentage. And, you know, why did Houston only have a 15-11 edge in turnovers in a game where they got burned just a ton of times trying to make, you know, the aggressive play and force turnovers? So, you know, like I said, it's hard to be, you know, too disappointed or let down, I guess, by you know, a tough road loss in conference against in a game that we knew was going to be tough and ended up being only a 2-point loss. And like I said, impressed with the way Houston showed a lot of fight to, you know, come back from a couple of very large deficits. But also, like I said, hard not to come away from this one going, oh man, it's just feels like a gut punch that you couldn't just do a little bit better and a couple of key areas that might have swayed the outcome of this game.
Yeah, this is a frustrating one. The Cougs definitely played well enough at times to win it, but I think, as we've seen in previous contests, the team partially put itself in too much of a hole early, and I think gave themselves really little margin of error to mount the kind of comeback you need to mount when you're down, I think, 14 after the third quarter. And it's a shame, because you can look at this game on the whole, and there were some definite positives. You certainly had a career afternoon from Cameron Jones. She's started a lot this year, but hadn't really had a breakout game before last Saturday. Had 16 points and 14 rebounds in 30 minutes played. Bria Patterson lately really looks like she's playing some of her best basketball in her Cougar career. She had 17 points and 5 boards, was respectable, 7 of 14 from the field. Really one of your better shooting performances on the season, finishing just under 40% from the field. And I think two things really frustrated me the most from this one. Obviously, the thing that's in your control, which is how many easy buckets that Iowa I don't know why I said Iowa State there. Tulsa. We're definitely talking about Tulsa. Tulsa was able to get, and I think how many times the Cougars were burned against a team that I think Tulsa's kind of designed to exploit the over-aggression and really find easy buckets if you as the opposing player are not in the right position defensively. And you saw it a lot, certainly saw it a lot in that first quarter. But I think it was also pretty frustrating in the first two quarters how often the Golden Hurricane were sent to the line. And I'm not going to say there weren't plenty of correct calls in there, and I'm not saying a correctly called game would mean that U of H and Tulsa had the same number of free throws. I don't think that. I think we've seen this team consistently struggle at times to really get to the line, do the things that you need to do to get to the line as much as their opponents. But I also refuse to believe that U of H did nothing in that first half to earn a trip to the free throw line in the first two quarters. I don't believe it's a coincidence, Dustin, that Tulsa only had four free throws in the second half, despite the fact that you usually, I feel like, see those numbers go up in the final two quarters as teams kind of maybe get more tired, get a bit less disciplined out there. I don't know. I think maybe that crew, and I know that they will swear to you, every officiating crew at every level, they don't keep an eye on those kind of things, but just like, we can't go 14-0 or 15-0 for another half and not really stand out from this game. So I'm not saying that U of H was robbed of a win or anything crazy like that. The Tulsa team that won this game deserved to win this game, but just kind of a frustrating thing for your team to be dealing with in a game that ended up finishing at such a tight margin. I mean, I guess you can't feel too aggrieved because certainly the Cougs let Tulsa score way too easy for the first three quarters of this game, certainly at the jump of the first quarter and coming out of halftime in the third. And this is a team that was coming in rated higher than the Cougs in the net. And ultimately, the scorebook will show this was a two-point loss at their arena. So maybe not skies falling stuff, but this loss kind of felt like a similar story that we've come on here and talked about this specific team in the last several seasons. Definite positives, periods of the game where the Cougars outplayed their opponent and looked like they could win this game, and yet ultimately not enough over the course of 40 minutes of basketball to get, I think, what would have been a really momentum-swinging, positive, critical road conference win.
Yeah, and you talked about the free throw margin, and you know, it's like I said, it was very frustrating, and as a fan watching that game, to see the one-sidedness of that free throw margin in this game. But you know, it's kind of been a season-long thing for Houston where they don't get to the free throw line real often. They only make about a quarter of their 3-point shots. And it's hard to score enough points to win a lot of basketball games when you are not making shots from the outside and you are not getting to the free throw line. You got to hit a whole lot of 2-point shots if you are going to not make threes and not get to the free throw line. And Houston, you know, like I said, had one of their better games of the year in terms of hitting those 2-point shots. But when you don't help yourself out with some threes or some free throws, it's hard enough to score enough points to win. And it's especially hard enough to score enough points to win when you have two different quarters in which your opponent scores, you know, in excess of 20 points at a 28 point first quarter, a 22 point third quarter. You know, that's in already just half of the basketball game, you're giving your team 50 points and trying to make up that over the course of four quarters with essentially just twos. And, you know, like I said, Cameron Jones, great game, 16 points, 14 boards, two blocks before fouling out. You know, she was getting some of those easy buckets that you need to get in order to keep this one close, but ultimately just, you know, Houston wasn't able to get enough high quality shots and not able to do enough offensively to help themselves out.
Yeah. Also mentioning here real quick, I was going to say, the USF game is happening tomorrow. We previewed it last episode, obviously going to be by far your toughest conference opponent. And the possessor as a team of all of the conferences, really sparkling non-conference wins, but a potential signature win for the Cougars. Sorry, was I cutting off your introduction to the USF game, Dustin?
No, that was, you're all good. I was just going to briefly mention, like you said, we talked about it, you know, Bulls really the only team in the American that has an NCAA at-large resume or remotely close to that. So suffice it to say, going to be a challenge for the Cougs, but also, like you said, huge chance to get a statement win if, you know, Houston has one of those in them. And then going forward, the Cougs will be at SMU on Saturday afternoon. You may remember Houston dominated the Mustangs at home to open conference play back at the end of December to the tune of a 60-44 victory. SMU has won 3 of 4 since then, but two of those three wins came against Cincinnati and UCF, to a couple of teams who look like two of the three worst teams in the American, and that loss that the Mustangs took in the intervening games was a drubbing from a middle-of-the-pack Memphis team. So not an SMU team that looks like world beaters. Definitely a team that Houston, I feel like, should be able to get the second win against. You know, like I said, they were able to comfortably win the first time that these teams met, despite committing 25 turnovers of their own to nullify the 23 that they forced. So, you know, let's see if maybe the Cougs can take a little bit better care of the basketball this time around and hopefully sweep their final season series with the Ponies.
Yeah, I think you took a lot of my points there about this SMU team. Kind of the book on them is that certainly we knew last time going in there were a team with some defensive acumen, but I think they'd pretty consistently struggle to score against anything close to quality competition. And I don't think anything we've seen in the four games since these teams last faced off changes that. I think it is worth noting this is a noticeably better team in the friendly confines of Moody Coliseum. They're 9-0 on their home court, 3-5 combined in road or neutral site contests. And close of a call as it was, this is a Cougar team that still only has one win in the current season away from the Fertitta Center. So I think it's a game that they should win, but it's also worth noting that and saying maybe that's a reason not to feel wildly confident, though I still think this is a Cougar team capable if they give a good four-quarter effort of seeing out this opponent.
And then the Cougs will be at Cincinnati next Wednesday. The Bearcats, the only AAC team without a conference win this year. They're 0-4, and only one of those four losses was even within single digits. They're comfortably the worst AAC team in the net rankings at number 158. So, you know, Houston has started out conference play by facing a lot of, I think, kind of the relatively tougher teams in the American. Oh, it's all relative in a conference that, like we said, only really has one good team this year. But even by the AAC's kind of lax standards this year, the Cincinnati team looks like the worst team in the conference. So even on the road, you know, if the SMU game is one that Houston probably should win, the Cincinnati game is one that the Cougs definitely should win.
Yeah, that was one of the more vexing things about last season, the way the Cougs dropped a home game to the Bearcats during their swoon last January, though a team did get some measure of revenge with a blowout win at the AAC Championships. Also, a little history there, too. The Cougs, two seasons ago, got a real resume-hurting loss to a Cincinnati team that wasn't especially good in a season where the Cougs ended up being the literal first team out of the field of 64, but this is a pretty bad team. They're currently on a 5-game losing streak. I guess that could change with their game tomorrow at ECU, but 3 of their 4 conference losses so far were by double digits, and maybe most damning, none of those losses were to the aforementioned league favorites, USF. This is one, really, the Cougs, again, with all the road struggles laid on the table, still not one the Cougars should expect to lose. I would go so far as to say this is a got-to-have kind of game if you want to feel positive about the rest of the season. I don't think I'm overstating it.
All right, so moving on, we're going to take our patron question of the week. If you, as we mentioned up the top, if you want to get your questions read here on the podcast, every week we are going to do a take a patron question. If you are a patron, you can go to patreon.com/shpodcast. You'll see we did a post there soliciting questions about a week ago. It's, I think, the second most recent post there on our Patreon page. So feel make sure to drop us a question if you want to get your question answered here on the pod. This week's question is going to come from Joe, who asks, what is your gut feel regarding fan enthusiasm for football going into the new conference? It regressed this year. Definitely true. I'm not certain whether casual fans will buy into a multi-year building process. We need to see setting season ticket sales records. Don't know whether the conference alone will make it happen. I think last patron question I threw to you, Sam, so I'll just go ahead and jump on this one first before throwing it to you here. So I do feel like there is going to be some pretty good fan enthusiasm heading into next year. You know, you get your conference opener against a TCU team that played for the national championship. We know that Houston's going to host the Cal College, which is definitely going to get a lot of people amped up. So this season definitely did see a regression in terms of fan enthusiasm for the football program. I do feel like going into the Big 12 kind of buys you a reset going into next year. I feel like people are going to be amped up to see those Big 12 games, but that's not a permanent set of affairs. You know, that doesn't mean that you're going to have an amped up fan base throughout the year. If TCU just absolutely smokes you, and if the Longhorns just absolutely smoke you, you know, that's going to cut into that fan enthusiasm real fast. So Yeah, I guess that's kind of my answer there, Sam, is that I feel like the enthusiasm is going to be there, but it's going to be a very kind of tenuous enthusiasm, which, like I said, that's kind of how Houston fans are. I think across most sports, it's definitely how University of Houston fans are. They're not going to keep showing up and in big numbers, as we saw this year, to support the team if they're getting their tails kicked. And, after a season in which, like we've talked about multiple times, there really were no good, exciting home games. There were some good, exciting games from the football season this last year. None of them took place at TDECU Stadium. So I think if that, I don't know about setting season ticket sales records. I would kind of hope that would be the case, because you're selling, season tickets to Big 12 games as opposed to American Athletic Conference games. But in terms of actually maintaining that fan enthusiasm and having those people actually show up and putting butts in seats and let's face it, having home games that actually feel like Cougar home games, because opposing Big 12 fan bases all have big alumni, pretty much all have big alumni bases here in the city of Houston. So if you want to see some Cougar games, some Cougar home games that are going to actually feel like you've got an excited fan base, I think the Cougars are going to have to show some results, because this is, like we said, it's not a fan base that's going to patiently wait around for a multi-year rebuilding process, like Joe said.
I had a similar answer to yours. I think I used a slightly different word for it. I think there's going to be enthusiasm, and I think some of the ill feeling and just disappointment of this past season, I think, is going to be, I would say, wiped out a bit once there's actually an official conference schedule out there. Once you officially see Texas on the home schedule, TCU on the home schedule, once you see a Houston Cougar football schedule that's all Big 12 teams, it's gonna be natural to, I think, be excited that this program hasn't had a slate of opponents like that since 1993 or 1994, the last years of the Southwest Conference. But I think it's a shallow enthusiasm. It's an enthusiasm that, if it's met by similar results against better competition, so worse results, I guess, on the aggregate to what we saw this past year, you're going to see, and you kind of alluded to it, I'll just flat out say, you're going to see a TDECU stadium that, just using this team as an example, is, and I don't even know if that's slating to be a home game, so don't, this isn't me predicting this as a home game, but just bear with me. You're going to see a TDECU stadium that, if this is a November game and this team is 3-6 or 3-7, that's 55-60%. Texas Tech Houston area alums or people who travel down from some other part of the state or country to watch the game. You're going to see a full crowd at the stadium, but it's going to be a full crowd that's at least 50% composed of visiting fan bases who, you correctly noted, almost all have fairly sizable alumni bases in the greater Houston area. I do think there's an opportunity to potentially be a 6-7 win team, but if that's a 6-7 win season where you actually got some signature wins in there, like if you have a season kind of akin to what Joey McGuire did at Texas Tech this year, I'm not saying it's apples to apples, because obviously going 7-5 when you're a first year head coach who was already pretty popular with how you'd handle things off the field, that's gonna be received a lot differently than Daniel Holgerson, who I don't think has won a lot of really strong fans or allies with the way he's conducted himself. We've had some good on-field results, but he's just not a guy who's going to go on a charm offensive. He's not a guy who's going to really go out of his way, other than the ball coaching stuff, to win the hearts and minds, other than sometimes putting good teams on the field. So I kind of agree that casual fans aren't going to buy into a multi-year building thing. I certainly agree that this fan base is many things, but I wouldn't say it's one that's going to stick around for a team that really struggles. But I do think there's going to be a bigger bump than maybe people are giving it credit for, and I think if the staff finishes the ground running and recruiting, I think it'll be maybe a bit easier to see that schedule and get excited and have a short memory come August. But obviously that could change very quickly, and frankly you could look at the last season, I think fairly argue that the most likely outcome is that it's going to be the same but worse because of the much higher grade of an opponent you're going against.
All right, and then moving along, had some other Cougar sports in season we want to talk about. As track and field opened its indoor season with the Leonard Hilton Memorial Invitational this past Friday, facing a combination of smaller Texas schools with a number of non-collegiate competitors in there as well. The Cougs were able to take 7 total event wins, 6 of those coming on the men's side. We mentioned in our indoor season preview last week that high jumper transfer PJ Harris III was someone to keep an eye out, and he started his Cougar career strong by winning the high jump, clearing 2 meters to get the event victory there. No surprise that Sean Maswangani won the 60-meter dash with a time of 6.67 seconds, still about a full tenth of a second off of his personal best, and certainly not the best time he'll run this year, but already a top 20 time nationally. Speaking of nationally ranked times, in the 60-meter events, Devion Wilson won the 60-meter hurdles with a time of 7.82 seconds. That actually is a personal best for him, and that is also good for number 14 across D1 thus far, very, very early on in the indoor season. And then another strong sprinting performance. JUCO transfer Trey East III won the 200 meters in his first meet as a Coug with a time of 21.38 seconds. That is number 33 in the country this far. It's still about 8 tenths off of his personal best, so definitely an event where I think he still has room to improve over the course of the season. And the Cougar distance runners had some strong showings as well. Brandon Seagreaves, who was consistently Houston's best cross-country runner this year, won the 3,000 meter by a full 5 seconds over his nearest competitor. And then Devin Vallejo Bannister won the 800 with a time of 1:52.36 seconds. That's a top 50 time nationally as well. Not as many standouts on the women's side in this first event of the year, but you did see sophomore Destiny Smith have a strong showing in the 60-meter hurdles. She won the event with a time of 8.37 seconds, just 1/100th of a second off of her personal best from her freshman season last year, so definitely encouraging to see that in event one, she's already in what was essentially mid-season form for her last year, so you figure if that you figure anyone is going to do better over the course of the year than they do in the first event of the year. So I think that shows that she is someone who has the potential to be an NCAA qualifier at some point, hopefully as soon as this year. Speaking of potential NCAA qualifiers, Priscilla Adejikun, one of the podcast favorites, athletes, had a toss of 69 feet, 5.5 inches in the weight throw, which means she had a narrowly second place finish in the event, but she actually was the highest ranked Coug nationally after one event, as that throw put her at number 11. So overall, some strong performances by the Cougs, but yeah, I think you can only take so much away from a single event, and looking forward to see what Houston has going forward. They'll be back in action this coming Friday at the Robert Platt Invitational, an event named for the late Cougar pole vaulter who tragically passed away in a boating accident in 2019. So you have to imagine that'll be an emotional day for this entire program, but look forward to seeing what the Cougs have in store for the rest of indoor season here, Sam.
Yeah, I think everything else we say about this meet is with the context that's the first meet of the season. You're not seeing any of these athletes' best performance. You're not even seeing probably close to it, hopefully. I always love the mixture. Obviously, established people. We knew if he participated, Sean Maswanyani was going to be one of the top guys. We talked about Davion Wilson as well. Very much an established name on the hurdle side for the Cougars, but seeing first-year athletes, PJ Harris III and Trey East, in their respective events. Destiny Smith, not a first-year Cougar athlete, is her second year in the program, but doing as well as she did in the 60 hurdles. Priscilla Dejikun, more of a familiar name as well. So, nice little start to the season. I think nothing huge from this one, but just nice to see the Cougars back on the track. Always fun talking H-Town Speed City here.
All right, and the Cougs, track and field, not the only Olympic racing sport that was in action, Sam, as the Cougar swimming and diving team headed to Florida this past weekend for their penultimate event of the regular season.
You're correct. The Cougars took a trip out east to the Magic City, the 305 Vice City. I promise I will stop listing nicknames of Miami, Florida, the perpetually humid city where the Cougars participated in a tri-meet with both the Miami Hurricanes and the Florida Gulf Coast, whatever Florida Gulf Coast mascot is. I'm not totally familiar with how they score collegiate swimming tri-meets on the team level, but I can say that the host Miami outperformed the Cougars fairly comfortably, and the Cougs, by a much wider margin, outperformed Florida Gulf Coast. The Cougs had a total of 20 podium finishes from individual events, got on the podium in both of the relays ran at this race as well. You had the 18 individual podium performances coming from 12 different Cougar athletes, and I think something from this one that really stood out to me, more of a big picture thing, was just how young the Cougs are compared to the hosts. Because one of the things that a meet result sheet has is the athlete's current age in years. And you could just kind of scan it and see that this was a much younger team than the top 25 Miami program that they were competing against, especially in the swimming events. You had a total of 13 podium performances in these swimming specific events, and 68 Cougar swimmers who are responsible are freshmen or sophomores right now. That includes your only swimming event win from freshman Alondra Ortiz in the 200 fly. Ortiz would also get second in the 100 fly as well. And the Cougs got a first place from one of your super seniors, Katie Deininger. Unsurprisingly, a name we're always talking about on the diving side of things. The Cougs actually took 1, 2, and 3 with Deininger ahead of Grells and Chase Ferris in the 1 meter. And like I said, had a host of seconds and thirds on the diving side. Like I said, the Cougs were a little more veteran and quite successful as well. I think we talked about it in passing last week when we talked about this meet, but Miami's tough competition. Preseason top 25 team by SwimSam, the publication I would say covers the sport most thoroughly at the collegiate level. And I think everything about this meet is the kind of preparation you'd want your team to have, with your conference meet looming in a month. You're on the road. You're kind of away from your comfort zone as an athlete against really good veteran opposition. I thought the Cougs really showed a lot of good things in this one. So as I kind of alluded to, this is the penultimate regular season meet. The Cougs will be back in action later this month at home with crosstown rivals Rice. That'll be this program's senior day before a final trip to the AAC Women's Swimming and Diving Championships in February, up 45 in Dallas. I think you've seen a lot of things here in the season thus far. I think to be optimistic about one last championship win here in a month.
All right, and the final Cougar team in action this past week is Cougar tennis, who got its season going in earnest with a matchup against number 5 Texas A&M. Ended up being a 7-0 sweep for the Aggies. Not a big surprise, as we knew that even taking a point off of one of the top teams in the country was going to be a big ask, but it really wasn't all bad. Houston was competitive in a lot of the single losses, especially freshman Sophie Scouten and Sonia Kovalenko were both able to take the first set of their matches before losing the next two. Laura Lasane's second set went to tiebreakers. Elena Trencheva's second set was as close as 7-5. Nobody for the Cougs in the singles took fewer than 4 games in a losing effort. So, you know, Sam, definitely too hard to get excited about getting swept. But, you know, you have your toughest match of the regular season right out of the gates here. And I think playing well enough to be competitive in losses to, you know, athletes from a program like Texas A&M could very well mean, you know, playing well enough to get wins against a lot of teams left on your schedule.
Yeah, I don't think either of us really expected the Cougs to be competitive with the number 5 team in the country right now. And that's the great thing about maybe having that be the match that you step into your season with, is that you don't have this immediate pressure. You know you're going against a really tough opponent that's going to push you harder than anyone on the schedule is going to push you, and kind of get that out of the way, see how you stack up against the absolute best of the best, and see what you have to work on. Like you, I thought it was pretty cool the Cougars were actually able to push some of the single sets, were competitive in some of the doubles as well. Don't think it's really, certainly not indicative negatively, I think, or positively. And I think good to see that the Cougars were a bit more competitive, and probably going to learn a bit more about this team in subsequent team matches. I think this one is just, okay, let's see how we stand up against the best of the best. And I don't think either of us are really terribly surprised this was 7-0. I think that was our hope. Maybe aspirationally, maybe take a point off this one, but I think more importantly, be competitive in some of these and just go from it, maybe learning a bit more about yourself. Cool. Also see Sophie Schouten, a very veteran team, to see the one freshman who I think saw significant action in this one stand out, I think is pretty cool.
No, there's two. Sonia Kovalenko, freshman as well, also had
that didn't sound right. Yeah, when it came out of my mouth. That's right.
Yeah, as I say, both of the sets that Houston were able to take in this one actually came from freshmen, so maybe a good sign for the future of your program there. The Cougs will be back in action on Saturday and Sunday in Waco, facing Baylor and UTRGV, respectively. Baylor, I don't believe I saw as a ranked team, so it might be a little bit of a slightly more manageable test, although the last time these programs faced off 2 years ago, it did end up being a 7-0 sweep for the Bears. And then UTRGV, a team that Houston is 10-0 against all time, so definitely you figure, if nothing else, ought to be able to get your first win of the season in that one.
Yeah, maybe nothing else. A nice little early test of how you are against opponents that are going to make up your conference next year and see, okay, yeah, we're 7-0 against A&M. That's understandable, I think. Maybe a little bit less aspirational to expect the Cougs to maybe take a point or two in that one.
For sure. Then before we go, do want to mention a couple of transfers. Transfer one each for a couple of U of H programs that got announced in this past week, starting with football, adding transfer Isaiah Hamilton. He was a cornerback, played the last 2 years across town for Texas Southern, was first team all SWAC this past year as a sophomore. So certainly someone who is taking a massive step up in quality of competition going from the SWAC, one of the lesser conferences in FCS football, to the Big 12, one of the top conferences in FBS football. So a big step up there for Hamilton. But like I said, was playing at a really, really high level already as a sophomore this past season. So I think if you can add someone who is a real high performer at the FCS level, that's something that is a reasonable add for the Cougs. It's something that you see a lot of programs do, adding those high-level FCS guys. And certainly cornerback is a position where I think is Houston's number one biggest position of need. So you know, whether or not Hamilton ends up being a starter, Sam, I think is TBD, but it's a position where you definitely want to be adding depth and someone that, you know, maybe even if not this year, maybe some at some point in the next couple of years is ready to make that step up in competition and play a big role.
Yeah, certainly a guy I think that had proven with this past season at TSU, and this was TSU's best year in a while. They weren't a great team, but they were. We dive deep on this in the premium recruiting pod, so plug for that, but was on a TSU team that was genuinely a good SWAC defense, despite having two FBS teams on the schedule, despite having functionally an FBS team in Deion Sanders' last Jackson State team this year. The Tigers still had very respectable season numbers, especially a pass defense that was certainly spearheaded by this newest Cougar there. I think a guy who certainly proved that he had outgrown the FCS level, a guy who was first team all SWAC, was on basically everybody's HBCU All-American team. I think time will tell whether or not his level is playing for this Cougar team and being good enough to break in a defensive backfield, where I think there are a lot of places up for grabs with a lot of seniors departing from the program this year. But I think undoubtedly somebody who proved that he could play at a higher level, that he could play at some level of FBS. And I think hopefully we see a guy who's ready for a pretty titanic step up in competition. But I don't think a guy unworthy of a chance at an FBS program. I don't think a guy who the staff simply is like, oh, he's good against the SWAC, it'll definitely translate. I think you've seen, though, it's not completely untrodden road to see guys make that jump, but will be a big jump. But I think certainly a guy who's earned a chance at this level or something close to it.
And then another Cougar fall sport making a big addition is Cougar Volleyball, who added transfer Katie Corelli from Ole Miss, an outside hitter who had been a rotation piece the last couple of years for the Rebels. So, you know, something that's a position that we identified as soon as the season was over was really Houston's, you know, I would say biggest, but also I think kind of only position of need, losing a couple of outside hitters in Cortland Henderson and the Idaho transfer. Whose name am I forgetting, Sam? No. Isabel Toy, the middle blood. Kennedy Warren.
Celeste Darling mixed up. Kennedy Warren.
So Cougars, you know, lost two of their three rotational outside hitters this last year. So we knew that's a position where they were probably going to add multiple athletes from the transfer portal. Had already added Nana Mabonu from Louisville. Now add Katie Corelli from Ole Miss. So I think that's exactly what you wanted to see heading into this offseason, was Houston adding a couple, athletes at outside hitter who were ready to come in right away and be part of that rotation along with Abby Jackson, who obviously presumably is coming back next year and will be your star once again at that position. But you really want to fill out the depth, and you want to add add athletes. Ideally, your ideal transfer is someone who's already proven that they're able to be part of they're able to play at a high level for a good team. And I think Houston has added now two of those in Mabonu and Corelli, and I think really gives me an even stronger feeling than I already had that the Cougs were going to be a pretty strong program heading into their first year in the Big 12.
And the staff has been quite good at specifically evaluating transfers, bringing in transfers who end up coming to this program and making a positive impact. Kennedy Warren, who you just mentioned, started her Division I career at Idaho. Kate Georgiadis, the libero extraordinaire, one of the best defensive players in the sport, started her career at TCU. Kellen Morin on this year's team started her career at Virginia Tech. I could go on and on and on. I think that the staff had the interest, I think, is in itself an endorsement of her and what she can bring here. And like you said, I think adds depth at the only position where your graduations really made you need to add depth, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think the only, you know, if Houston is going to add anyone else in the portal this offseason, maybe you get, you know, one additional middle blocker to have a kind of a third rotation piece along with Moore and Rachel Tolles up front. But, you know, I think even Houston had some other young middle blockers. So if the staff thinks that one of them is ready to kind of step up and be kind of the third woman in that rotation with Moore and certainly stepping into a bigger role next year, I think I'd be perfectly happy with that as well. But yeah. So, you know, maybe we see maybe one more addition or something like that. But I think this roster, as it already stands, is going to be a roster that's going to be ready to be extremely competitive in the Big 12 next year.
No doubt. Really seems like you have champagne problems coming off your best season in almost 30 years.
All right, and that's where we'll go ahead and wrap up this episode. As always, want to encourage you, as we've been doing throughout the episode, if you enjoy the Scott and Hohen podcast on a regular basis and you're at a point in your life where you feel like you can afford, you know, maybe a couple bucks a month, we'd love for you to go to patreon.com/shpodcast. You can sign up to make a recurring monthly donation to support the work that Sam and I do here on a weekly basis. You will get the premium episodes that we've talked about. You can ask us a question right there from our Patreon page, and we'll get your question answered here on a podcast sooner or later. And also, you know, all those supporting us, whether you've been supporting us since the beginning, whether you're a recent supporter, very much appreciated by Sam and myself. So thank you to all of you that are already making that decision, and definitely encourage you to do that if that's something that you feel like you can do. We also love hearing from you, the podcast listener. You can email us, shpodcast@gmail.com, or you can tweet at us at SH Podcast. So that's it for us. If you made it all the way, almost 90 minutes into this episode, congrats. You are absolutely awesome. And as always,
go Cougs.
Go Cougs.
Vamos los Cougs.
Go Cougs.
Go Cougs.
Go Cougs.
We ain't invited to the party. We had to kick the door in. No cap. No cap. No cap. No cap. No cap. No cap. No cap.